I'm Dr. Angela Coombs.
And I'm Dr. Jen Sotsky.
And you are listening to The Breakthrough Session, the Columbia University Department of Psychiatry's podcast. We are two early career psychiatrists grappling with the most pressing issues in mental health today, both inside and outside of the office, with the help of our guest experts. Today, we are joined by none other than Dr. Lloyd Sederer, who's actually the former chief medical officer of the New York State Office of Mental Health. Before that, he's probably the only psychiatrist we know that actually had 8 million patients. He had 8 million patients because he was the former commissioner of mental hygiene in New York City. So welcome, Dr. Lloyd.
Great to be with you guys, work with you guys.
So Dr. Sederer, how do we understand addiction today and why it's become so widespread? We basically can't open a newspaper or go online or walk through a hospital without seeing evidence of addiction.
Or evidence that we're just not making enough headway in saving lives with people dependent on opioids and now other drugs. Mm-hmm. So there's a convention about addiction, which has been promoted by a lot of scientific groups, that it's a chronic relapsing brain disease. And that's true, but it doesn't say beans about addiction. It, you know, it tries to equate it with other chronic diseases. And I've come to understand addiction essential. Let's just take opioids. Why do people use opioids? They use them because they're so effective. Same way with alcohol or cannabis or stimulants. These drugs are immediately and powerfully effective. They relieve somebody's pain. They relieve their psychic distress. They transport them to some other place. This is why people use substances. And any approach that's going to make a difference has to start with the appreciation that people use these substances for a reason. It serves them. And that informs our entire approach. And that's different from saying it's a brain disease. And it is a brain disease, but it's not only a brain disease. It's a psychological disease. It's a social disease, a complex disorder. But it starts with the person. It starts with knowing that that person is using because it serves them.
So I kind of wonder from your take, what is driving such a persistent sort of failure when it comes to historically our treatment of substance use disorders?
There are a few ways that this country seems to have liked to go about trying to beat back this epidemic. And it was best captured. Churchill said, you can depend on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And that's the story here. So what does this country do? It tries criminalization and control as if we didn't learn anything from Prohibition. We played that hand once before. And the only remaining vestige of that is organized crime. It did not change people's use of alcohol. Control and criminalization is very common, and the prisons and jails are filled with people with substance use problems, and that's not where they need to be. So criminalization. The other is interdiction, the war on drugs. You know, you see these pictures of soldiers in Humvees at air, you know, at borders, and they're capturing, you know, 1,000 pounds of this or that. So this is a game, and but has it substantively reduced the flow, or has it, or reduced the deaths from these conditions? No, but it's a very popular strategy with good photo ops. And then the third strategy we're very fond of, and doctors, I think, are particularly prone to this, is exhortation. Don't you know that stuff's going to kill you? Don't you know it's ruining your job or your family? So these are three very common, and that was used as a strategy in this country by a school program called DARE, which was scaring kids.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. Yep, me too. I did DARE.
Bring a cop, and you know, a cop in blue with a prisoner, and basically say, do you want to wind up like this? And it actually had a opposite effect with these kids, because kids are drawn to risk. So those are the ineffective strategies, and they continue to be employed, and a lot of money invested, even some of the big federal grants, always ensure that there's money for border interdiction, there's money for criminal actions, rather than moving all the money into what I think of as a public health approach. I'm a public health doctor through two jobs, city commissioner, ML health commissioner, and state medical director. And I've learned that the complex problems can be beat, but not in those manners.
Right. So if it were up to you, what do you think we should be doing differently on a kind of larger societal scale, but also as two young doctors that are working with patients with addiction?
So there's the short-term horizon, 6 to 12 months. And that's something that New York State is, I hope, going to achieve, that the biggest reduction. So if you're a public health person, the first thing that you consider is how many people are dying from this problem. And we see the numbers growing. So what is the most effective intervention to reduce overdoses and reduce overdose deaths? And that's medication-assisted treatment. There are three FDA-approved medications for this, buprenorphine or Suboxone is probably, I think, the best. And when you look at people who have overdosed, nearly killed themselves, and on buprenorphine, their survival rates are so substantially greater than those who have no treatment in the 6 to 12 months after their overdose. So, and Vivitrol is another effective, maybe not this different, and some people like it because it's not an opioid, and buprenorphine has opioid properties. And then there's the big lifesaver called Naloxone, Narcan, the reversal drug. I carry a two-pack of it in my backpack. And I know people who, in their briefcase, and they've had use of it, in a Starbucks on some highway. But it is about distributing this very substantially to families, the people who are using substances, and to the general public. So the biggest way that we can reduce deaths in the next 6 to 12 months is by more prescribing of these medications, which reduce craving and consequently reduce overdoses and reverse the overdoses. That's the biggest thing. It's short-term, and it asks a lot of doctors and some nurses, because they've got to do it, and they've got to get their head around that this is the right thing to do for their patients. Maybe I shouldn't ask this, but, have each of you become buprenorphine prescribers?
We sure have.
Yeah.
But I think similarly, though, to what's actually shown in the data most recently, that, you get your waiver to prescribe, and then it's often the case that you're not prescribing like you might have intended to.
Right.
And so thinking about, there are some barriers that still exist for prescribers. But even taking a step back, I imagine for some people listening, historically, when we talk about substance use treatment, people think about rehab, people are thinking about 12-step programs, people are thinking about a lot of different things and not necessarily medications. And while we have phenomenal evidence, I'm wondering what we can do to speak to folks who either for themselves with their own substance use challenges found really meaningful for community.
Yeah, so let me take it from the immediate to the broader. And one way to do that is through a little tour of our brain. This addiction is really a tough disease. It's really hard to unroot from different brain centers. And when you can intervene at specific and different areas that make a difference with addiction at the same time, there's a augmenting effect. You're doing more. You're amplifying the effect. So, for example, the reward center, right? So that's the ventral tegmental area and nucleus accumbens, but that's what it's called. But basically, that's where dopamine is released. That's where we get the hit, or the DNA hit, and it fires a certain cycle. So that's a very important part of the brain to intervene with, and that's what medication-assisted treatment does, is that it reduces the dopamine spike. It reduces the release of dopamine, so the reward cycle is mitigated. So you could see that as the accelerator pedal, and you're doing something to reduce the pressure on the accelerator pedal. That's one thing. Then we have a way of encoding in our brains what is salient, what's important, what we want, what we need, and that's our memory centers, particularly the amygdala and the hippocampus. And this is really important because most relapses are related to cues. And Pavlov's dogs are a really good example. He taught the dogs to salivate, not to the food, but to the bell. And it's very similar with people with substances. They're in recovery, then suddenly somebody calls them who's high, or they watch a television program where people are getting high, or Prince dies. And the next thing they know, that cue has triggered them. So this center, this memory center, is an opportunity for intervention. And that intervention is generally a cognitive behavioral intervention. It's teaching people what the triggers are, what they can do, how they can control that part. So now we have two parts of the brain. Then we have another part of the brain, which is called the orbital frontal cortex. So these are big names, but basically this one is our motivational center. And what does that mean? It means I just had took something or saw something or felt something. It felt really good. I want more of that. That's motivation. It's about the pursuit of what gives us pleasure. And that's a center also to focus on in terms of treatment. And the approach, a fundamental approach there, is called motivational interviewing. It is about getting behind somebody and supporting their motivation to go from being a user to starting to not be. So that's another center. Then finally, there's the frontal cortex, right, where reasoning and judgment exists. And this has been called the break. It's not a very good break because of the power of these other centers, but that center can be enhanced. Its influence of the influence of the frontal lobes can be enhanced by human relationships, by family, by 12-step. When you think about what is a good treatment plan, you think about how are we going to affect each of these centers so that we're intervening at four different parts of the brain at least, and we're enabling somebody to stand the chance, because these are interventions that are additive to one another.
Dr. Lloyd, what if, and I've heard people make this argument before, kind of going back to the medication-assisted treatment, what if people feel like, I don't want to trade one addiction for another, and I don't want to be on medication. I want to be totally abstinent, because I know some of the medication treatments, they do give you some of the effects of some of the drugs, some of the reward sense. How would you kind of respond to that?
It's a great question, Jen. It is the ideological question on the table, because the buprenorphine does occupy the opioid receptor. It is, but people don't get very high on it because there's a ceiling effect, which also protects against overdose respiratory arrest. But it is an issue, and some people who in recovery, who themselves have had abstinence-only recovery, they think that this is a violation, and they give people a hard time if they go to 12-step groups about this. I think this is a stigmatized drug, but it has its downsides. It is about using a substance, but you can function on it, and it means being on it for quite a while. And many people have a hard time coming off of it. So it's not, an ideal. It's not like, eight treatments for Hep C nowadays and you're done.
Right.
So it is a complex drug, but you're facing the likelihood that this person is going to use again. They're going to do the things that enable people to use, which is to get money. So they steal. They deal in drugs, and they prostitute themselves, and then they take an overdose. So that's the course for so many people. So it is about, do we have a life-saving drug? Well, we have a few of them now. And also, maybe it's easier to distribute naloxone. But that's a tension that needs to be addressed because it's very underprescribed. Not, as you were saying, Angela, that many docs have the qualification to prescribe and don't. So it's a really good question, but it is life-saving. And for some people, it's just not the right thing. But then you have these other interventions, cognitive therapy, support groups, family support, motivational interviewing. You know, you got to throw a lot at right. this disorder to make a difference.
I think it's really helpful, too, how you break down the different sort of parts, essentially, of a whole entire brain illness or experience that these different interventions are addressing. And I know people talk explicitly about medication-assisted treatment really also addressing the anti-reward pathway when it comes to
yes.
opiate use disorder. So it's not just about the pleasure somebody experiences, but for many people, it's no longer a pleasurable experience, but rather they're warding off the feeling of actually being awful, like feeling awful, dysphoric, so on and so forth. So thinking about, you know, for us as we sort of close out, you know, takeaways and think about what we do when we sit in front of patients that are navigating, you know, not maybe not just even substance use disorders, but a variety of experiences, really connect them to the care that's most appropriate for them.
It's a great question. And I think there are key messages that we need to convey to patients and their families. First is that there's an incredible amount of evidence that people recover from substance use over time, but we're not very good at saying when. We don't, not very good mm-hmm. about when. But, and then the other thing, back to your other point about buprenorphine, and the paths to recovery are quite varied. Mm-hmm. Some people, you know, they just do it by themselves, others with support, 12-step, you know, medication, et cetera. So there are many paths to recovery, and people recover. So that's important in terms of the really main message is hope. Because you have to keep hope alive during the times when people relapse. Everybody gets demoralized. They think it's over. The person who's using, their family, even clinicians. So it's about keeping hope alive.
Well, we appreciate that. I think this has been a really sort of nice overview of what sort of needs to shift, and it's part of our thinking. And it's not about, you know, if somebody is interested in non-medication treatment, that they can't sort of have that, or that doesn't have some really important implication. Like we talked about cognitive behavioral therapy, we talked about motivational interviewing, we talked about 12-step. But when it comes to saving lives, when it comes to really moving the dial forward with this opiate epidemic, particularly that we're thinking about or talking about here, that we need medication-assisted treatment. That needs to be a part of this picture. We can no longer sort of have this chasm between traditional mental health treatment, primary mental health, and substance use. We need to really be addressing the full person.
Thank you very much. That's yeah. exactly what we need to do.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Lloyd.
You will be joining us for every single week as our executive producer. Nevertheless, we appreciate your presence with your expertise on this particular matter.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us today at the Breakthrough Session. We'll see you next time.